opponent. And it looked good. It won points for him. And Malcolm learned to do the same when he was being interviewed by somebody trying to do him in. He would watch the hand, and the last 15 seconds, he would deliver some verbal thing, and the show was over. And this man, who had all these collective things about him, brought to what he perceived as his mission, which was to make, if I might put it, make a better world for you. That was very important to him. He was very big on education. Another anecdote I remember one day, and this was significant in lots of ways. One day I was driving with Malcolm. He was driving, I'm in the passenger seat. And anytime you're driving with Malcolm, you're a little nervous because you don't ever know what might happen. And we were in Harlem, and all of a sudden, Malcolm stood up on the brakes. The car screeched, had a blue Oldsmobile, and I knew we'd had it. And when I know anything, he has slammed open the door on his side, gotten out, and he's standing like an avenging devil over three young black men who are shooting craps up against a door. And what it was that door was the Schomburg Collection, within which is the greatest collection of material about black or African American people in existence. And Malcolm was shouting at them. I never had, that's the angriest I ever saw the man. And he was saying, other people are in there studying, learning more about you and your people, and the best you can do is be out here shooting craps against the door. And then the really impressive thing was that these young men, 19, 20, 20, something like that, you know, furiously looked up at who dared, and when they recognized Malcolm, they, as the colloquial expression goes, tucked tail and went quietly slinking away. Now, I believe there probably was not another human being in Harlem who could have done that. Anybody else, they would have probably cut his throat. Those fellows, they were tough young street guys. But Malcolm's power, his image, his force, his charisma, his presence was such that when he challenged them, when he embarrassed them, that was the course they took. And I don't know, I guess I could go on just giving you anecdotes or things about a man who obviously I tremendously admire. And I don't know if that answers your question or gives you some insight to him. And the other thing I could say is just read the book. And okay, all right.
Oh, I read the book and plus a lot of others, FBI files, the whole nine yards, everything. And the thing about the national holiday, I mean.
Oh, the holiday business. You know, it's a thing. It's very similar to what the young man was asking about reparations. That too is being talked. It's not as organized. I was, and I'll tell you where they're very strong on it now, is Howard University. And it's just being, to my knowledge, the best I know is that it is being discussed. And what will come of it, I don't know, but I know that there's a lot of pressure. What it needs is some central force to get behind it. It's now scattered, spread. Mm-hmm. Okay.
One aspect of racism, I guess, in the 80s, 90s that I wonder if you could address for a moment is heightened tension between the Jewish and black communities in America, much of which I think may have centered around people like Farrakhan, Jesse Jackson, and not their entire message, because almost every, well, I can't speak, many people who are offended by their some of the Jewish things, anti-Semitic things that they've been associated with, believe in their other messages. But some of the anti-Semitic tensions surrounding those two and people like the rap group Public Enemy, Spike Lee, and some other popular figures, I think have contributed to a heightened tension. I wonder if you could address that. Is this tension really there? Is it media created? And what can we do about it?
Excuse me for a second, Ms. Kelly, but this is going to have to be the last question this evening. I'm sorry for all those who didn't get to ask their questions, and I want to thank you, everyone, for coming again. Thanks.
What did she say? What? I was watching him and I heard not. What did she say? Oh, that's the last question. Oh, okay, all right. Okay, brother. No, well, you know the thing about that, you are, as you know, all asking things that are kind of weird, widespread, particularly in the East. You know, interestingly, the things, with the exception of the holiday for Malcolm X, that's heard on the West Coast. You talk a lot about it. But the other things that you're asking are mostly things you hear in the East from traveling around a lot. I think that this is just from my personal observation that there has been, if you're talking about the controversy and the oftentimes conflict between Jewish and African Americans, that's in essence what you're talking about, right? Is that right? Well, I think that that probably has had its genesis in big cities like New York, Chicago, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, so forth, and it goes back to the genesis of it beginning, that's the same thing, genesis and beginning, but is a time when hostility began to grow out of, say, when a high percentage of merchants who were Jewish were in black communities. And as the black communities evolved, there began to be this, not fights, certainly not, but verbal fray. And I tell you when I know, when I'm aware of it first beginning, was in the time of a man called Marcus Garvey. This would have been in the early 20s. Marcus Garvey was able to come from the West Indies and to organize the biggest organization, I believe, that ever was of African-American people in this country, principally in New York City. One of the tools he used to do this was to point up the percentage, the number of Jewish merchants in the black community. And his thing was, which was a very elemental and very effective thing, was he would say, our money is being taken out of the community. And I think that was where this began. And usually when you have something that is as potent as that, it is going to leave a legacy down successive generations. There were things, different incidents that would happen, like later on in Harlem, a boy was, African-American boy was hurt, and the rumor swept. It wasn't true, but nonetheless, the rumor swept that he had been killed in a store which was owned by a Jewish family on the corner. I forget the exact name of it, but I remember it very well. And these things were ugly. They were ugly in two directions because each group would create the counter things for each other. And that's why you can ask the question you asked today. At least that's the genesis of it. I couldn't give you any kind of learned response about it because there are agencies bigger than you and I combined and multiplied many times who are trying to deal with this. The Anti-Defamation, you know, B'nai B'rith, various other groups. And I have met with them and I am very much a member of organization, you know, Christians and Jews, and speak for them or go different places for them. Because my concern is we the people, if it's possible, to try and learn better to get with each other. And I really don't have the kind of answer that's specific that you may be seeking.
Maybe more specific, just to follow it up, is there really a purpose to the anti-Semitic overtones of someone like Farrakhan, who has so many other constructive things to say, and does he represent a real tension, or is it just imagined?
You know, the best person, and I say this not to be whatever, but just to tell you the truth as I know it, The best person who could tell you what Farrakhan means is Farrakhan. That's true, you know. Yeah. And now, what I know of him goes back to Malcolm X. When I was working with Malcolm, Farrakhan was proudly called Malcolm's little brother. He called himself that, and Malcolm called him that. If you listen to Farrakhan today and close your eyes, if you knew Malcolm, you realize you are hearing the phrasing, the intonations. It's almost like Farrakhan studied Malcolm. I don't know if you know, Farrakhan used to be a musical performer. I think he wrote music and he played in Boston. What he does is he plays upon the imaginations of people. People make of what he says almost whichever hobgoblin they wish. And he, in turn, says and carefully phrases whatever he says so he can say it's something else. That's why I'm saying he's the best source. I really don't identify as being his spokesman. I don't feel that's my role. I speak for me. I write books to say what I think, you know, and I'm just saying, that's it, you know. Okay. Is that? I don't see where she is, so why don't we, before she's not looking, let's have one more. Go ahead. Go ahead, Ellen.
I think it's great how you're so positive.
Wait, let me hear it. Now start. Go ahead. I just couldn't hear you.
I think it's great as you ended your formal lecture. You're so positive, and you're saying that we are the promise, that the dream of people before us.
I don't know why I can't hear.
You can't hear.
The young lady is saying that, don't I think, notwithstanding the positives, that this country has so much further to go, that there's so much racism and related things, and of course, you're absolutely right. The best way I could think to respond to that, if I can say it as he said it, was a thing that Dr. Martin Luther King said when he was queried somewhat in that area, and he said, something like, we ain't where we was. No, we ain't where we... Does somebody know that quote? Yeah. Huh? Yeah, it said, the young lady gave it to me, we ain't where we ought to be, but we ain't where we was either, and that's very true. So I think that, you know, a very interesting thing, you see, the very fact that this young lady comes up and asks that or expresses that is a long way from where we once were. So you, to me, represent the progress that's being made, and the fact that we recognize that, yes, there is a very, very long way to go, and there sure is, no question. But we are not where we were, that's for sure. I just left, I was telling some people, and this is sort of ad lib, I was in New Zealand and Australia. There's a group of people, brown people in New Zealand called the Maoris, M-A-O-R-I-S. And I was so taken aback to go there. Here were these people who were rather much like the Native American. They were there when the Europeans came. Now the married people in New Zealand are roughly, you might say, where African American people were in this country in the 1930s. Just about that. And then if you keep on over, as I did do, to Australia, now there's a group of black people there who are called Aboriginals. And they are, in political terms and social terms and just generally, I'd say it's not unfair to say they're about where we were during the Reconstruction. So it's relative. And somehow those of us who have been fortunate enough to begin to move, the very act of moving involves being less tolerant of things that are in the way of moving faster and further. And so that's the spirit in which, yes, there is a lot more to be done, a long way to go. But I just like to find, I like positives to deal with. On every sheet of stationery I have in this world, at the bottom is a line that reads, find the good and praise it. I didn't think that up. I saw it on a bumper sticker in Los Angeles. And I liked it so much that I have had it put on every, as I say, every piece of stationery. And I think that my own particular feeling is that we can make more progress looking positively at how to do that rather than looking negatively behind us or something like that. That's just my thought. Thank you much.